Welcome to the ThinkSpace podcast with myself, John Stoskowski, and Danny Massaro. Our goal with this podcast is a simple one. We discuss and dissect a prescient topic, issue, or theme that we think is interesting and might help us humans better understand why we think, feel, and do what we do. If you'd like to engage in these types of conversations too, you can check out thinkspace.academy for a unique cohort-based course that will help you think critically and live authentically. Hope you enjoy the episode. Right, Danny, psychologically rich life. This was a concept that I think has been around in different bits of literature, but we're talking around a paper by Lorraine Besser and Shigehiro Oishi, which came out in 2020. And I think that was the first place it was really formalized into a bit of a framework. What they posit in the paper is that typically psychological science, if you want to call it that, has tended to conceptualize a good life in terms of either happiness, so things like pleasure, positive feelings, life satisfaction, or meaning, which is more like a sense of purpose, sense of service and virtue. So the first one is what you'd call like hedonic, and the second one, so the meaning one, is what you'd call eudaimonic. And they were basically originated around the time of Aristotle when he was talking about what makes the good life. So these authors are talking about, well, what is it that makes the good life? And they wanted to add a third leg to that. So rather than just a happy life, a meaningful life, they brought in this concept of a psychologically rich life as like a third leg to the table that makes up an all-round good life and what it is to live a good life. And they define the psychologically rich life. They call it a life characterized by complexity, in which people experience a variety of interesting things and feel and appreciate a variety of deep emotions via first-hand experiences or vicarious experiences. That's how it differs to a happy life and a meaningful life. So, Danny, where do you want to start off with that?
Okay, so, well, when we decided we were going to do this, it was something I pushed for because you sent me something about this.
A while ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, the psychologically rich life. You know, you sent me a big article and I thought, what's that? It just really made sense to me because obviously, especially us two being academics and, you know, and well, me, I would never call myself an academic at all till the age of, say, 30, really. You know, I was always interested in things, but never thought of myself as being into that information and stuff like that. I'd been a teacher probably from the age of sort of 22 to 20 to 30 before maybe 28 to be fair, 29. I started getting into coaching theory and started getting into psychology and stuff like that. So maybe then I did start to really, you know, absorb myself into texts and books and things, and the internet came along and all of that. So I started being able to research easier. But, you know, what I felt in the last sort of 18 years of my life as such is that a big important part of why I feel quite good all the time is because I'm always learning stuff, and I really feel like my brain is kind of, you know, like firing a lot in a good way, firing on all cylinders in terms of, you know, it helps me feel enthusiastic. I'll think, oh well, you know, whatever else happens today, I've learned that, or I've read that book, or that's something else I've understood. And then you ask more questions, and then you have different kinds of conversations, and that led me to do some qualifications, and then obviously just finished recently with getting into PhD type territory in philosophy. Well, if you'd have said that to me when I was 30, I would never have gone anywhere near written philosophy or research methods and all these things. But I've had so much joy and meaning and pleasure out of it. So when we talk about a happy life or a meaningful life or a well-lived life or what is it to live well, I really think there's a place for, you know, like keeping your brain alive in terms of the thinking and curiosity side and not getting brain dead by just being too busy. And I am aware that I've my life's panned out in a way that I've had a lot of time on my hands. So I know that I've been able to fill that time with that. But I am aware of a lot of people like squash players who I work with, or other athletes and some friends and things. And it seems they're so busy that they don't often get the chance, apart from summer holidays or, you know, breaks, to really sit down and study something, you know, and really get their brain sort of like pushed, really. you know. So I thought, well, this is worth kind of talking about and maybe helping a few of the listeners think, oh, maybe one of the ways to a bit more of a happier, optimal sort of feeling and pride or whatever it is inside, feeling of living and being less bored or less stressed, might actually develop a bit more of a psychologically rich life by each day or, you know, each week.
I think that's why I originally sent you it, because, and I don't mean this to sound in like a big-headed way or like kind of big us up, that aspect of, like, I think I read it and thought, this is me and Danny, this, and like, yeah, kind of read it and thought, this sums us up, and sent you it. And I think maybe part of that is because, I don't know if you noticed this, but a lot of my mates and family and stuff probably think I'm a bit of an oddball because I'm constantly reading stuff and like just getting into, like, you talk about philosophy, different bits of psychology, and just maybe watching like random films, reading weird books and stuff.
Yeah,
I get a buzz off that and you buzz off that, which is why I think we click so well.
Yeah,
but I think sometimes you can get seen as a bit of an oddball because it's like, what are you doing? Like, where's he got that from, or why has he got onto this? But in my mind, it's just like, it's not on purpose, it's just because I'm quite curious and I enjoy learning new stuff and finding out new things and just pushing my own boundaries, that this notion of a psychologically rich life, I think, appeals to me. And I can really see what they're getting at with this, you know, some of the studies that they've done on it and some of the papers they've written.
I think what we've got to be careful of when you're sort of that way anyway as well, I suppose, and what I've seen, I was sent a book, I didn't finish it, but ironically, called The Ravenous Brain, was something, this theory that your brain can get addicted to information and new learning. And you know what I mean? Like, so the learning becomes a drug, and that the brain is ravenous for information all the time. It's like a classic one of those books. They sort of said everything it needed to be said in the first chapter or two, and then it was a massive book, so it was a bit daunting. But I do remember taking a few points from it, and it just clocked in my head. I thought, yeah, you have to be careful of not just thinking and learning things and taking information in because you're an addict to it. You have to have breaks, and you have to be able to leave it alone for a while, perhaps, you know, and like you might say, detox and stuff. But generally, that's probably talking about extreme information grabbers and thinkers and so on. But I think the average sort of normal everyday person, I consider myself to be, and although, you know, might read a bit more than normal people, but still within an area of just getting on with a normal life, I do think that the average sort of normal person can get a lot of benefit by learning stuff, learning new things. You know, I was with a guy yesterday who's got his own business, and he's William, a coach him at squash, and I went to see his business where he works, and he actually sells ball bearings around the world for massive machinery. So I was looking at him, he was so into it, and I said, how did you get into this? And he's like, oh, I've just always studied it, you know. And this guy's a really, you know, good lad, and he's always happy and he's always good, but it turns out he's like one of the world experts on all these different kind of ball bearings and what they do. And you know, he sort of stocks these very, very rare ball bearings for, like, you know, an oil rig somewhere, or, you know, that oil rig might need a ball bearing straight away. It takes 2 years to build it, but he's already put one on stock, so he becomes highly, they need it, and he's highly specialist. And it was like, he said, oh, I'm fascinated with it, you never get bored of this subject. And what that reminded me of was like one of the things that Lisa Feldon Barrett said in 7.5 Lessons About the Brain, that one of the ways in which you can help your brain, which she thinks is a prediction machine about what's next and so on, and how the world is, she sort of said, if you can find one area sometimes and study it really deeply of interest, rather than loads of areas wide, you know, you might generally like to be interested in things, but if you can find one topic and go right into it, obviously like this guy had done with the ball bearings, you end up understanding subtlety and nuance and complexity and differences of opinion even in one area. So that is like a lesson in keeping your mouth shut when you're talking about things you don't know about. It's a question, it helps you sort of feel a bit like, wow, there's all these different theories around this. So before I go banging on about, you know, politics or this, and with so much certainty, maybe an ethics and morale, maybe I just need to calm down a little bit. So I think that's another benefit of it. When you keep your brain learning and understanding differences, a bit like we do on our course, we're deliberately getting the participants like to think differently and from different sides on the same thing, and they go round the roundabout and come back round, and you know, their beliefs have to change a little bit. They go back into their lives And I've been getting reports that they're a lot less like judgmental or a lot less stressed, or they feel like that they can ride the waves of what's to come a bit better because they've used their brain to think around things in a useful way rather than a reactive way.
I think that's a really interesting part of it. I mean, you mentioned the course. Really, all we're doing on that part of it is we're trying to make people psychologically richer. That's ultimately what we're doing. We're throwing all this mad stuff at them to get them. Maybe thinking about things they've never thought about and looking at them in different ways. And I think that this is what the original authors were getting at a little bit. So probably an important caveat to make that they're not, and we're not for a minute saying that a psychologically rich life is better than a happy life or a meaningful life. And the original authors weren't saying that either. In fact, they're probably saying that these three aspects are all kind of part of a good life in different amounts and at different times, at different points in life. But they're not trying to say one is more important than the other. But I quite like the way that, so you mentioned someone there who, you know, taking the stuff that we've done with them on the course into their everyday life. That's what the authors were saying as well, because one aspect that they get is, well, look, you can have a really happy life where you've got lots of comfort, lots of joy, you've got security. That's facilitated often by things like money, good relationships, positive mindset, etc. So you can have a happy life like that, but that can get a bit monotonous, can get a bit boring. So even though you're really happy and you're really satisfied in your life, that happiness and satisfaction can become monotonous over time. Likewise with the meaningful life. So the key features that they use to determine that are things like significance, purpose, having a sense of coherence in what you do. They're facilitated by moral principles, consistency, again, relationships. They throw religion in there as well. That can be a big part of giving people a meaningful life. And the main outcome for a meaningful or of a meaningful life is feeling like you're contributing. So that's societal contribution. So you, again, you could have a really, or feel like you've got a really meaningful life, but again, that can get a bit monotonous and it can get a bit boring, even though, you know, you're buzzing because you go, well, I feel like I'm adding, I'm contributing. You know, people are benefiting, society is benefiting from me being here and doing what I do. But they were saying that that can get quite boring. So it's that aspect of novelty, I think, that the psychologically rich life brings. But I want to know what you think about this. What they said was that doesn't necessarily mean it's good. So you can have lots of novel experiences, you know, lots of interesting things happen to you and you do lots of interesting things, but they can actually be quite painful sometimes as well. It's not necessarily good novel experiences. You can have some really bad novel experiences that end up in, you know, maybe some quite dodgy stuff happening to you, but they're psychologically rich experiences. So I don't know how you, that third dimension that they add in, I just found that interesting that it's a little bit more, it doesn't always have to be good, because if something's just good all the time, it gets boring and monotonous. You need these moments of, you know, maybe upset and bad things happening to make your life a bit richer in that sense.
Yeah, the ups and downs, that, you know, the downs, they'd say they make the ups feel a bit better.
Yeah.
Like when we had that heat wave for 2 days, the 40 degree one, I was like buzzing off the breeze for the next 3 days. Yeah. It took 2 days for me to love the English weather more than I've ever loved it. It's like, you know, without that, it made me appreciate that a bit more. So yeah, but like ups and downs. Sometimes when you win at sport, it's partly is that you didn't lose because you don't like the losing feeling because you felt it in your bones. Emotions like revenge. Obviously, something had to happen badly, you know, schadenfreude or all these things we've done. But I think that element of it is getting out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, big time.
How much do you want to go out of your comfort zone? You know, because there are extremes and you might not come back from them, you know, that so that, and they could be life changing in a bad way. But then so there's like risk to that as well, you know. But like you say, you know, like if everything's so, they talk a bit about self-sabotage, don't they, that people are so comfy and bored. The century of the self was interesting about how, you know, we talked about last podcast about, and Adam Curtis mentions it on Can't Get You Out of My Head, the new version of it, you know, that had come out in 2022, that there was a lot of people in suburban America that had everything that they wanted, but then were so bored, felt lifeless because they weren't living the adventures of the ups and downs. The comfort zone was so big, you know, you had to go to an extreme to get out of it. But what actually they did instead, the doctors just gave them loads of pills to basically not think just to switch them off.
Yeah.
Like happy pills, just to dope them out. Like, and that was, it, weirdly, it was actually part of the slogan, the advertising slogan for the drug about, you know, zone out, you know. So it's like, dope them out. So I think when you're living, so if you just say, took it from an experiential point of view, if you go traveling on your own and you don't know where you're going to stay that night, if you go to another country and you can't speak the language. So when I traveled around the world at times, you know, with the squash and all of that, there'd be times where you'd be a bit, in the early days especially, it wasn't as comfortable. If you took a psychological approach to it, you were learning from it all the time. You were observing people, watching things. Although it were a bit scary and you actually at the time wouldn't have, you'd have, oh no, can I not go in that 5-star hotel instead of this one? You were actually experiencing and learning a lot from it. If you take it from an educational point of view, you know, you've got to be ready for these things. So if you're getting pushed in a classroom off a teacher and it's too far, you don't want to go out of your comfort zone for that, you know, I don't understand it and it's doing my head in and it's too hard. The skill of teaching, I suppose, is knowing the learner and taking them far enough where they will go, but it's not gonna collapse them, so that they actually take some psychological learning, some benefit from the experience of the lesson, and then they're more likely to do that again. So I think that experiences that you go and they stretch you, let's say, if like COVID or something like that, if you can then take like an almost like an interesting psychological angle to it and think about what's going on, because you're reading books around that, or you've got some more time on your hands, so you get into another project, you can actually start to survive it better. And all the while, you're kind of upskilling your life, because you're literally like growing your dendrites in your brain. You're actually growing your brain power because you're learning things. Whereas I think if you don't do that and you're in the comfort, like, go back to century of self a bit. Whereas if you are just about being happy and that's all it is, I suppose, and your brain's not used to like clocking that it's getting a little bit itchy, a bit bored, and it needs some information to learn something. You know, it wants some new information. It wants you to think through a problem or something. Then you're probably going to have to go and buy something. Purchasing, isn't it? The only way you're going to snap out of boredom is having an amazing holiday, gathering another 25 photographs to put on one of your social media platforms to sort of PR your own life. Come up with some creative tweet because you're bored and you want some nibbles on that. You are going to go out shopping, you know, and that's expensive. And the good thing about the psychological life, you know, I mean, tweeting might not be, but it was shopping. And, you know, like, obviously the Century of Self last podcast was all literally about, let's play on those bored emotions and let's make them buy things, because they'll make them temporarily feel good every time they buy a new product or get a deal or a bargain or something. Whereas a psychological, if you can get stuck into a book or a podcast or a film, or you can go for a walk, and you can really be interested in things and look at some buildings or nature, and your brain's that way, really cheap. You can fulfill your time and not, you don't need to spend money and be buying things and having magical experiences, because you're so curious and you're so into learning where you are. There's so much that you can fill up your life with that isn't, you know, the latest product or gimmick.
You see a lot of people, don't you, get, 'cause I mentioned that happy life, typically in the ancient Greeks called it the hedonic life or hedonism, didn't they? You see a lot of people now trapped on that hedonic treadmill, don't they? If they're all about living a happy life and it's about happiness above all else, then it is, a lot of it is serviced by buying something. So you buy the latest, I don't know, get the latest iPhone, the iPhone, whatever they're onto now. And for that week, first week, it feels amazing, doesn't it? And it's like, brilliant, it does this and it does that. And then, but quite quickly, you just get used to what that phone is now. And that just becomes now your baseline again.
Yeah.
But then you're constantly on that hedonic treadmill chasing, right, well, I need the next leg up now, and the next one and the next one. And it always just brings you back down to that level. So you're always chasing. So this Oishi and Westgate, I hope I'm not butchering her name, O-I-S-H-I, I'm calling her Oishi. But this is Oishi and Westgate's 2022 paper. They say in there, so this is a direct quote, "Unlike happiness, our conception of richness allows for moments of discomfort and unpleasant emotion." So that's exactly what you just were talking about there, when you're traveling and things like that and just getting in novel situations. yeah, some of them emotionally might be quite unpleasant at first. And it probably is only in retrospect, really, that then you look back and think, oh, yeah, that was, you know, that was rich. That was a rich experience because I learned this and I took that from it. And so there probably is that looking back. And they do actually mention that. So one of the proposals that they put in this study that they did was they expect that people who lead psychologically rich lives will tend to have a more complex life narrative. So when they look back on the life and they talk about the life, there's a lot more complexity in it. And by that, they mean, you know, a lot more of those ups and downs.
Yeah.
They might have been in some dicey situations when they went traveling on their own at some point and didn't know where they were going to sleep that night.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot different to maybe someone who's just lived in the same place for 15 years, worked the same job, very happy, and they live a happy life, but they don't have that complexity to their life narrative or the life story.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I personally feel a bit uncomfortable with the, you know, like the traveler type life. I'd find it, oh, where am I staying, where am I sleeping, and so on. But I'm not uncomfortable going into the academic, informational world of things in the areas that I'm interested in. I'm not into physics or maths or chemistry, really. I mean, interesting, I suppose, but I'm into the sort of more the mental, the psychology, the philosophy of life and so on, like obviously we're doing here. So that does stretch me, but it's not what I mean. We're not saying, oh, traveling is the answer to everyone. I mean, if it doesn't switch you on, it's just going to be pure pain and you're not going to learn from it. Same with sport or meditation or whatever it is. You're right. But I think like the quote that I like from it was, on their deathbed, the people who led happy lives might say, I had a lot of fun. People who led meaningful lives might say, I made a difference. And people who led, you know, more biasly sort of psychologically rich lives might instead say, what a journey. And that's exactly what you just said, because you've always been thinking and reflecting and pondering. They might call that a growth mindset and package it up now or something like that. But yeah, essentially, it's just being interested and reflective and pondering and contemplative and thoughtful. I mean, Socrates, know thyself, you know, so it could be an internal introspection, thinking about, why do I do that? And why do I think this? And wonder where I came from? Why is this? So you can have an internal sort of investigation, but you can have an external one where you've always questioned and been curious. And because you've done that a lot, nothing apart from the obvious, you know, massive things like illnesses and deaths and all that, nothing's been very overwhelming because you've always been able to sort of take a view on it and angle it. So everything's been a bit interesting. Things have been a bit more interesting than just a thing to get through and get rid of type thing, or to keep hold of no matter what. It's like we said with Heidegger about being towards death. Take an interest in what it might like to be as you age and go to death. Don't shun it out like, and never think of that. And by contemplating it and by thinking about it, it actually isn't as depressive and horrible as you think. It can actually be very liberating, you know. But again, it's not easy to, if you're not that kind of person, don't do it. Do something else. But that's where you might have that, you know, what a journey it's been. It's been full of so much difference. All the different decades I've lived in, all the different theories, all the different, you know, all the different phases I went through in what I believed about the world and what I thought was important. You can almost laugh at it all. And I think that's great, because I think it's like, if you're intellectually curious and you're curious about yourself and you're curious about how things change and are sometimes absurd and complex, I think that allows you as a person to go through your life recognizing and laughing at yourself a bit about all the different phases you go through. So it keeps you quite flexible. You can go, God, I used to think that in my 20s. And then you go, God, I was a right idiot when I was 40 to 43. I was all into that. And I said, I'd never do this, but now I do it. And I think that's why someone who's perhaps lived a psychologically rich life is more like the person who'd say, what a journey I had. I was everywhere.
That's a key part of it. You mentioned a couple of them then, but this was another definition that they gave in that last paper. So they predicted that openness to experience is a huge part of being, you know, someone who would live a psychologically rich life, or it would foster psychological richness. Yeah. And they characterized that by, so this is a quote, vivid fantasy, artistic sensitivity, depth of feeling, behavioral flexibility, intellectual curiosity and unconventional attitudes.
Yeah.
For them, that made up an openness to experience that would then lead to more psychological richness.
Well, that's interesting because Jordan Peterson talks about that, doesn't he, on his big five personality things and that. And this is where, you know, complexity comes in. When you look into personality theory, some people are just wired more to perhaps be open. Like that openness, it's called trait openness, isn't it? So if you
I still think you can adopt that. So you can almost force yourself to go, right, no, I'm actually gonna open myself up to stuff. So maybe someone invites you somewhere to do something.
Yeah.
And normally you go, no, I can't be bothered with that. I'm not doing that. Maybe it's like, no, check yourself and go, no, I'm going to do that. I'm going to go there, or I'm going to... Well, it's not even you. Something reminded me of, remember that mad film we watched? It still haunts me to this day with Colin Farrell.
Yeah. Is it The Killing of a Sacred Deer?
Killing of a Sacred Deer. So what these authors are saying is that...
Talk about get out of your comfort zone.
So it's not just about... So things like novel experiences and openness to experience, it's not just about travel and stuff. They're a good example, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because it's easy to kind of put yourself in someone's shoes who's traveling. But they're saying as well, it's... You know, you're enriching your life through novel experiences via things like literature, film, music, sports, the art. Mm. So even on that micro level, so that for me was a good example. That film, Killing of a Sacred Deer, and we probably would recommend it to people.
Well, it's Nicole Kidman and Colin Farrell, and the acting's fantastic. It's by the director who did The Lobster as well, and that's just weird films, but, you know, it's so off the charts, isn't it? You've got to laugh.
It's a good film in that it's well acted, but it's proper weird. And you do, I came away from that thinking, what have I just watched that? It's proper matter. But I think that's a good example of, you could have just switched off after 5 minutes and gone, Danny's having a laugh at you. What is he on about with it? Whereas now I'm like, he must have recommended it for a reason. I'm going to sit through it and watch it. And I'm open to that experience of just seeing
Interesting. I watched it again because I'd said, oh, I watched this once on somewhere and I think it's up your street. And you went, what is that? And I was buzzing because I freaked you out. I was like, I can't believe it. I thought you were like proper hardcore. And you're like, no, it's done me head in. I'm like, oh, brilliant. So then I rewatched it and I thought, yeah, it is a bit weird, isn't it? And the acting's so haunting, it's great. But then I went on Wikipedia on it, which is, again, what a facility, you know, being able to do that these days. You know, Wikipedia and the internet is unbelievable, isn't it? You know, flipping heck. Go around to someone's house back in the day and they'd have 25 red encyclopedias and it just overwhelm you. But now you can just go bang. So if you want to be interested in things, it's so easy to learn and all the links, it's class. But it was actually a Greek myth tragedy. So the film was built on one of the old Greek stories of like it was a revenge. It was a haunting revenge. But it's really no different than what's in Peaky Blinders, you know, at the end with the gypsies and that he cursed the child, you know, and they couldn't work out why the child was ill. And is it a curse or is it actually modern medicine? So you have this really interesting thing of this child was, you know, losing the ability to, like, you know, move about and stuff. And it was like, it's science versus sort of curse, you know, so a bit eerie, you know. But again, by then digging back into that, you understand the film in a different light. And in a really weird way, then it lost it, you know, it's not as like freaky as you think, because it's just explaining, you get the what it's trying to get at. It didn't destroy the magic of it. You don't want to be one of these people that, I mean, I'd probably get laughed at off all my mates. I mean, I know I do. I'll go into things too deep. They're like, bloody hell, you're too deep, you know. It was only a film. Why have you gone into it that deep? Looking, you know, going into the themes and what it was trying to get at and stuff. Sometimes, you know, obviously people aren't in the mood for it. But I don't think they begrudge me that because they sort of know how I am. You know, they're just like, oh, it's Danny, isn't it? That's what he's like on that bit. But even if somebody said to me yesterday, oh, it was your next podcast, I was thinking, and I said, oh, Psychologically Rich Life, and they said, oh, what's that then? I was like, yeah, what is it? I was like, well, for me, I said, wherever your current level of knowledge or psychology is, it's just stretching it a little bit. So you could be a baby, you could see, you know, you could be a young kid who's interested in things, you know, looking at stuff, taking information in, curious. You can see curious babies, curious kids. Kids who ask questions. It doesn't mean that they're not as psychologically rich as I am. What I think it is, it's wherever you are at, you are stretching your brain in a tiny little way. If you read your first first ever book, that's stretching yourself. If you get someone and say, "Oh, I've just read an autobiography by some reality TV star," you know, I might go, "Oh my God, what, she's written a book?" But to that person reading that book, if it's genuinely stretching their understanding of themselves and the world, it's the best book they can get because it's effective. It's actually making them understand things more, and it might be on the journey to a, you know, another level of book that might take them into somewhere else. So it's not about highbrow and being snobby and really being highly intellectual and highly curious wherever you go. At the very, very first instance, it's just taking an interest and being slightly curious. And then I think what's really good about it is a bonus effect I've found is you can teach it. So who doesn't like telling somebody something and they go, "Oh, thanks, like, oh, that's interesting." I don't care who you are, when you tell somebody a story or sort of an explanation of anything, how to work something, what something means or where something came from, or you know a bit of information and they didn't know it and you pass it on, you feel great when the other person says, "Oh, that's interesting, thanks, how do you know that?" And you go, "Well, I've read a..." I mean, that's just one of the great buzzes in life. For any, you know, you see that everywhere, you know, even you see that in jokes, you see that in gossip, you see that in anything. So I think that when you're curious and you gather little bits of information up and you read around things, you become quite an interesting person who can actually buzz because you can teach. And then when you're an interesting person, people treat you differently. They treat you because you're interesting and you might be a good laugh. You just don't treat you because you're just a good laugh. It's another layer of a life. It's another, you're actually, you can go into new situations and you can have chats and debates and people can go, "Oh yeah, what a good laugh John was. But yeah, interesting as well. I didn't know he was into that. Very, very fascinating guy." You know, that's a great part of living a life, I think, as well.
I do think there's an element of the rebel to it though, especially, you know, with all the stuff we've seen in the last couple of years with, we are kind of being coached, aren't we, by society and education to some extent to not question, not challenge, don't you go reading up on that. You don't need to know about that. This is what the expert says. So you just listen to us and, you know, you just stay there. You've got comfort, you've got security, you've got a job, you're happy, you just stay there. I do think there's an element of rebellion that comes in where to live a psychologically rich life, you've got to kind of go against the grain a little bit now and you've got to challenge what's...
Maybe in the mainstream, like, yeah, and... But again, on just a daily, normal daily level, I think, you know, on a friends with friends and chatting with family, I still think people like to appear knowledgeable and how knowledgeable they actually are. It could be bullshit or it could be just they've read it in the newspaper or they haven't really gone into it. But anyway, whatever. But I'll tell you something was interesting. I always think comedians are quite spot on with social observations. Mickey Flanagan are dead funny. If you watch The Sacred Killing of a Sacred Deer after this, you got my permission to watch Mickey Flanagan straight after to cheer you up.
No one's coming back to listen after they've watched that deer film. That's it. We've finished our audience off.
Yeah, put an hour of Mickey Flanagan on before you go to bed if you watch it. But he was just an observer, and he said, "God," he said, "have you seen TV these days?" He says, "Everybody's going around like it's cool to be thick."
I just think people are a bit thicker and selfish now, aren't they, generally? People are thick as shit now, aren't they? Self-centered. "I'm thick as shit!" Thick people used to hide, didn't they? You've never met many thick people. They used to be hidden, didn't they? Don't let them out, he's thick. Take him home, he's thick. Take her home, thick as shit. Now, they come on the telly. "Hey! I'm thick as shit! Where's Africa?" Oh, fuck you, I can't even read.
But yeah, so somewhere along the line, I think being the Mickey Flanagan was like, where did it get trendy to be thick? You know, so there's always a cultural thing going on, isn't there? When, you know, at the time, as much as it's trendy to go on Twitter nowadays and sort of shout opinions like you that you've done a master's in politics, it's also part of the culture that if you are a bit thick, it's fine. It doesn't matter.
I think, though, especially with the social media stuff as well, that there's almost like a fake psychological richness. So you see the people who are very outspoken with regards to politics and certain things around that. So they can give the illusion that, no, I'm reading more than you. I'm looking at stuff that you don't see. And But even those people tend to be very absolutist about a particular team, don't they? So it's, you know, whether I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican. And it's like, you don't know because you've not read this and you've not seen that. And it's like, But they're still, so they might look like they're reading more and they're curious and they're open, but actually still very just, they're singing from the same hymn book all the time, aren't they?
Well, it's smoke and mirrors, isn't it? It's that illusion of, you know, that's always part of life. But we know that, don't we? University, you know, you go in, every time you go into someone's office at university, you've got 1,000 books on the shelves they've never met. It's just basically, it's frightening the shit out of the students. Yeah. One day, son, you will also be able to read the quantity of words that I've digested into my brain. And you're like, they've never read the bloody book ever, just buying them. But that's going out now, isn't it? That's kind of all changing. And the actual that actual professor or teacher, I mean, you're still going to get the odd one who's read them all, of course, proper top one. But the majority of people I know, by being in the company, at the end of the day, they haven't read a book for bloody, you know, they're not. You can tell because they're doing the same lecture they did 10 years ago now, or 5 years ago. Nothing's new. So they're not actually keeping, they're just banking on what they once learned. Maybe they're too busy or whatever, but they're giving the illusion that they are really into the that's constant psychological development. Now, I get it. Now, one of the caveats to this, in terms of the, you do have to make the effort. You do have to find the time. You have to put time aside to go, no, it's very valuable to me to keep my brain alive and switched on and firing. For me, I think when I was at school, and this is an interesting one for school, for a lot of people is a crap experience in terms of learning because you're a kid. Why do you want to sit in a room all day chomping around unless you learn how to do it and you're just some white, you know, some brilliant kid who's just switched on like strange in a way, you know, exception to the norm. But most kids are in school and it's just like, it ends up being like their experience of learning and psychology is just like, get me out of my head. I need to be doing stuff. So I think if you can get older, 25, 26 to 30, you know, and then you can slowly start to sort of learn, read a book, read some information, watch a documentary, go on and find some more stuff out, maybe do a little course, get into a topic, that can help you get over that belief that you're not clever deep down, that you're a bit thick because you were crap at school, or you never did A levels properly, or you didn't do you never like, I never applied myself. Maybe 1 year I did at my A levels, I failed them, and then I had to redo them. And I think for 6 months I genuinely did get my head down out of pure fear of not going to university. But I only wanted to go to university for the laugh and the life. I didn't want to go to learn, so I literally learned nothing at university. I remember going and just being like, how can I just get through this assignment and do this? I mean, the odd lecture were great, you know, I'd like it, but I wasn't ready for it for whatever reason. Other things were more important. And I think then as my life went on, I think it's helped to get the monkey off my back that I'm not that bright deep down. I'm not clever. I was never in the top sets. I was always in the sort of bottom sets at school bottom to middle, really. I did climb a few bits as I got a bit older, but nothing outstanding. I was more sporty and active and so on. But, you know, I think that it would be a shame to go through your life thinking that you're not bright or not using all the potential that your brain has, you know, not stretching your thinking. And literally, you know, like this time of year, I have a lot of friends that are just sat around and they're just desperate for the Premier League to start because they just need the entertainment about the transfers, the gossip, you know, the results, the drama, because the brains need something. They're not in the mode of like perhaps picking something else up and really mentally getting into something else. You'll be into your football, you can still watch Sky Sports, you can still be into all of that, but that's brilliant because then it's pure happiness and pleasure or whatever it is. But over here, you've got this particular moment of your day or your week where you really sit down and get your head down and get absorbed into some like pinging information that you're taking in.
I don't see it as that. I see it as a 24/7 thing. I don't see it. Certainly me, I don't think in my day I'm going to set aside some time now to be psychologically rich.
No, right.
You know what I mean? It's like just 24/7. You're constantly just like, you don't even know when you're doing it really. You're just looking at stuff or you're just switched on, aren't you? And you mentioned school there. Again, I don't think that being psychologically rich gets rewarded at school. I think you'd be more likely to be punished for that or sanctioned for that.
That's interesting.
Because you've got the curriculum, you've got a timetable,
right.
You've got, you know, so a lot of kids end up coming out of school, primary, secondary school, hating reading, for example, because they've been told what to read. They had zero choice in what they wanted to read a lot of the time. It's like, this book's on the curriculum, this is what we're reading.
Right.
Now we're going to analyze it to death. And we're going to come up with what the author was meaning and what this meant and what that meant. And it's maybe like, this is the most boring book in the world. I don't even want to read this. There's very little novelty and curiosity. You're not being rewarded for that, are you? You've probably been punished for that.
Mm.
If you ask too many questions, you know, well, can I not read this instead? Or why have you got to read that? I want to do this.
Yeah.
You'd get knocked down, wouldn't you?
Yeah, to conform into the...
Yeah, so it's almost like no... And again, it's not that one's better than the other, but that aspect of a happy life, that's what is almost drilled into you at school. It's like, no, to be happy, you need to get a qualification. Because if you get a qualification, then you'll get a job. And when you've got a job, then you'll get money and you can buy a house and you can get married and have kids. And it's almost like scripted fear, isn't it? And that's sold as the happy life.
Yes.
And the psychologically rich life, which you would have thought would have been more what education's for and what school's for and what university's for. It's almost like the opposite. It's like, no, don't you be going off on your own tangent there. I've got the knowledge. I'm going to tell you what you need to know, and I'm going to teach you this, and then I'm going to give you an assessment to test whether you've learned it or not.
So in a funny way, you're right there. That's a great point, because I'm just thinking, curiosity is what fuels learning, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you shut down curiosity in children, like cut it at the stem, and it's a process of basically banking your memory banks with what we're telling you to remember.
Yeah.
You for life, you're shutting down the fuel of... I know it's not full freestyle curiosity, and there will be certain schools out there that believe in that. So it's finding more of that balance of, obviously that comes from the home as well, doesn't it? And what's going on at home and things. And
I see my two nieces now, so they're 15 and 17, and they were voracious readers when they were young kids. So when they were like 4, 5, 6.
Really?
They always had 3 or 4 books on the go. That's all I would ever buy them for, like, birthdays and Christmases, because they just loved reading. So we'd even do a thing where it's like I'd put them like a little handwritten voucher that I'd made in a card.
Yeah.
And the whole thing was like they would come round and then we'd go uptown and we'd see which book they wanted to get, and then that'd be the present kind of.
So you weren't just a boring uncle that would be.
No, I was. But now,
brilliant.
They would honestly, if I gave them a book now, they would laugh in my face. They would just be like, what's am I going to do with that? They don't read anymore. It's just been absolutely knocked out of them at school. So when they were more at home, because you're younger and you spend more time with your family and that, they were into reading and they just buzzed off it. Now it's like they just associate reading with schoolwork,
really?
And like boringness. And it's like, why do I want to read that? It's, you know, they want to be on TikTok or whatever. And that's where the curiosity comes in, I suppose, there.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, so I can see it just on that level. It just gets knocked out of them. That curiosity for reading mad stuff that's not on the schedule at school is gone.
Well, I know we've been at university and you've left now, but one of the things I know frustrated you was that there were too few students, even on the masters, that came with the curiosity, doing the reading around the topic, challenging you and throwing curveballs back to you. It were literally just that they were like, just fill, I'm an empty vessel, fill my head up, please.
Yeah.
I'm interested to a point, but it was generally for the qualification, wasn't it, for the job. Also, I'm paying for this, so they almost got a customer attitude. Like, you do, don't you? When you've paid for things, you do. So that's in there as well. You know, you're not criticizing all people, but because when you're a customer, it's weird. You do turn into a bit of a, like, I deserve this, so just do it. So it changes the dynamic. But generally, the best students, and they tended to be more mature students, you get some odd brilliant kids. You're always going to get great learners, and we'd had some fantastic learners and still do, really good. But I remember a couple of kids we got home from Afghanistan who struggled with the language, and they'd made their way over, and they were just in heaven, weren't they? Hanging, they used to hang off my every word when I used to teach, because they were like, wow, writing it all down. You know, we had a girl from Iran last year, you know, a lovely, brilliant girl on the masters, Mahoosh, and she was like, every little slide, every information, every question, every ponder. She really, by the end of the 2-hour lecture, she'd properly worked her brain, because, and it was so good. Now, I remember as an undergraduate, graduate student, being at university, I would probably only be in that state when the teacher was unbelievable, phenomenal, and actually took me on a journey, and not really my, you'd be hard not to be interested. But by master's level, at least, going on to a master's course, you expect everybody to be really by choice to be like that. Is that what frustrated you a bit with it all? Is that what you like about?
Yeah, it's definitely a big part of it. And I don't want to start dumping on students, because I genuinely don't think it's their fault. That ultimately they've just been socialized into that by the system they've come up through. So if ever, you know, whatever it is they do, SATs now, is it 6 or 7? I can't remember, or if they even still do them. But everything about school and learning has been tests and exams, and you've got to do this to get to the next stage, and then the next stage, and then and it's always just this conveyor belt, isn't it? And university is no different now. It's just another step along the way. And now the thing is, well, you need the degree certificate if you want to get a job. And like with Super, the happy life, you need a job to get money and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So that's how they're measuring it. So I don't blame them, but I just thought there's got to be a better way to it than what we're doing. You know, otherwise, big part for me was I just felt like I was selling my soul a little bit, because if I'm thinking all this stuff and saying this is shit and we should be doing this, but then I just go along with it anyway, then I'm no.
So here's a question for you. Do you think, this is literally an honest question, it's not arrogance or anything. Do you think you psychologically outgrew your job?
I don't know how answering yes to that doesn't sound arrogant though.
You're like better, your particular role, your job, your situation, your predicament, not all lecturing roles and all professorships and all teaching jobs anywhere. I mean, you know, you could go into an under tens, under eights, and find it so intellectually stimulating. Literally saying your particular role that you were in, do you think because of the reading, because I think this is a thing, I think people are frightened sometimes to get to stretch their brains, because it opens Pandora's box, and then they look at their own life and go, oh shit, I know too much now. So basically, I didn't want to know this much, I didn't want to look that much at it and have these other options, because it means I've got to actually jump ship or I've got to change. So I'd rather just almost stay a bit thick, a bit doped out, because I don't want to know too much. And after you got so sort of stretched, and you're so in, it got boring for you, because no one was going with that level of sort of, I mean, I've felt that a little bit myself on my module that I work on this philosophy. But luckily for me, I can manipulate that module however I want, because so I'm always changing it. So I don't feel bored. I know you were as well, but I don't know.
Yeah, I would definitely say those three dimensions of the good life sum it up. So, you know, in terms of happiness, I was comfortable in my job. I had a lot of job security, good money. You know, I was pretty well. I could have stayed there another 10, 15 years easy, couldn't I? And just kind of ticked along doing what I was doing. So it was happy, meaning you hit maybe, let's say, 10% of students, like you say, the ones who really switched on and you really connect with, and they're there and they're just buzzing off the learning. They're not bothered about the degree and stuff. They're just there because they want to learn and develop.
Yeah,
I think, you can definitely feel like you contribute to those people. So, you know, like the Afghani student that we're talking about, there's no doubt that you and maybe me to a little extent contributed to his life. And I definitely think he's a better person and a better human being having worked with us for that period of time. So you can definitely go,
You're on the train home thinking, oh, well, that was a good job. And, I'm good.
So you can take some significance from that, and then that gives you a bit of purpose. You feel like you're contributing. So you've got happiness and meaning. But I would agree, it got to the point where I didn't feel like it was psychologically rich, because I was just
churning it out.
Yeah, it was kind of just folding it in. Yeah. There wasn't really much. It didn't feel that effortful, or you didn't really feel like, and I don't think this is uncommon, the view, you don't feel like you get rewarded particularly for example, pushing students' curiosity and, you know, making them feel like they're living a psychologically rich life. You're not really rewarded for that.
No.
Ultimately, it's looked on, well, did they pass on? What grades did they get? You get to the point where you feel like, well, what's the point in doing all if it's only hitting a smaller proportion of students? And so, that's why I packed it. But I don't blame the student. It's just that they're just products of a system. We all are. We're all products of what we've been socialized into.
So I coach across the full spectrum of from little 5-year-olds who've never hit a ball to, you know, 65-year-old hackers who've never been that good at squash but just love it, to club players, to the world's the world number one, right? Through all the full range of all of that, you know, young pros and good amateurs, and different ages, different genders, everything. And the one consistent thing for me is that I always feel like they are with me and interested in my ideas, and they ask questions back, right? So they, you know, obviously not the 5-year-old so much, but you can see it in their eyes. Can you show me that again? Can I do this? And then they do something and they want to do something else. And you can see. So yeah, so in terms of that, like, I think for me, when I connect mentally and when I get meaning from sort of stretching someone's brain a bit, I think my job as a teacher, a coach or whatever, as a person, is to help the person like elevate their enthusiasm and themselves a little bit, so that even if the results don't go well, they've learned something and then they might build on it. You know, I've got lots of players that, to be honest, you know, I'll help and work with. It's brilliant. And they get better, but it's very difficult to really make massive strides in a professional career when you've not got the real grounding, you know. But they love it and they miss it when they can't have it. And I think that's because I almost take an educational, psychological approach to how they're learning the game and what they're getting from it. And they feel like, all right, they might not get you're going to win and you're going to lose, but they love the life. Because they're learning all the time with it, and the way I am. Now, I'm not for everybody. So, you know, my sort of, you know, a psychological approach and always getting them to think and take responsibility and learn, and, you know, I want responses to those questions, and I want you to go into it. If they can't really last that, I switch off. It doesn't matter if they're one of the top players in the world. I can feel it. I just don't, these days, I don't need to do it anymore. I'd much rather be with the person that's like buzzing mentally with me on the same page. And I think that for me, you know, when we talk about happiness, meaning, rich, for me, you can't, as it says in the article in the end, you can't separate them out into these separate areas. They're so intertwined with each other that happiness, meaning, psychologically rich, like that can all come in one moment doing one thing. It can make me feel psychologically good, happy and meaningful, bang. You know what I mean? It's hard to really, we have to separate them out to talk about them, and then, but really in real life, they're not separate. They're in a full package. And I know you asked me about, you know, you were going to ask me about Leo, weren't you, being a dad and old.
Yeah, so my thinking was that because, and I know you don't mind me saying this, but you're obviously a little bit older than most dads, aren't you, for having their first. I think you're 48 now, aren't you? You had your birthday not long ago. So as a 48-year-old first-time dad, I think you've got a bit of a unique perspective on these. I thought you just turned 48.
Yeah, but you were 47 when I was born. It's really important that 1 year.
It doesn't. It's all the same, isn't it? Once you get past 28, you're finished.
I'm old.
But those three categories, so happy life, meaningful life, psychological richness, as a 47-year-old, I think you've got, and just because you're into it anyway, you've got a good idea of all those things,
yeah,
and that narrative of your life and stuff. Yeah. Whereas most first-time dads are probably in their 20s, 30s.
Yeah.
So they don't have clearly there's a miles on the clock thing, isn't it? They don't have as much life experience.
No.
But I just wondered, oh yeah, I wonder what Danny thinks about that. So having a kid that later on, you know, what does it add more of? Does it add more happiness, more meaning? Does it make your life psychologically richer? Where does it fit in for you around those three categories? I just thought, I wonder what he'd think, because it's I think you're quite a unique.
Yeah.
As someone who I would say already lives a psychologically rich life, I would say you're happy. I definitely think you've got meaning in your life, and you know, you've got this psychological richness. I wonder how he feels a kid adds into that.
It's just sort of like, you know, like a spiral, like an oscillating spiral going up type thing. It's just gone up another level to like a higher and bigger, wider circle on top of, you know, like a spring going up type thing. It's just more joy, but through the meaning as well. Really interesting. Really, it's a bit like if I died today, it'd be like good, like whatever, because you know, not, you know. Because I'd be dead, I wouldn't care, would I? I'd be gone. The shit for everybody else, but I'd be gone. But basically, Leo needs to have his life. I've had mine. I could have checked out when I was 40, and it was more than enough in terms of all the experiences and all the journey and everything, right? You don't want it to. You'd want another, if you could do it again 10 times, you would. You can't. So, but yeah, with him, you think, like, it's all about you in a way. Like, I'm still going to take everything I can have when I can get it. You know, I'm not quitting my personal, who I, you know, what I want to do in my life, but not even a question, you just die for him. Like, if you had to, I'd die for you, yeah, boom. Because you deserve your go. You deserve your go at it. So in terms of, like, weirdly, like, that's profound, really, inside. When you actually know that's in your bones, that's true. It's very profound. That's the difference I've found, the main difference. Like, this profound sense of, I don't know, maybe heritage, lineage. Like, you can, you've had your good time and you've left. So it's meaningful in that way. It's also very interesting. It's, like, mentally, like, obviously new. So it's a new experience. So there's that mental side of it. I wouldn't say it's, like, necessarily the intellectual part. I still get that bit from other areas. I still like reading about new things and watching documentaries, doing these podcasts, learning new stuff. So that's still, it's not really been affected. But I think my overall happiness is just there a little bit more. But I was happy anyway. So if I were to say anything, I'd say it was the meaning. I'd say it was mainly the meaning, but out of the meaning, the happiness and the psychology, like, falls out of it. But it's not like I'm going around constantly extra happy than I was. I'm not meant psychologically in a miles better place or anything in terms of that. But meaningful wise, I think in my existential reason for being here and why and my sort of like thinking of my whole life, I'll tell you what it has done. It's really made me feel like being an old dad. It's like, wow, what a long life I've had. All the, like, there's about 30 phases to it. Because in a weird way, you're sort of reliving all the moments he's going to go through. And I'm going, God, I remember those moments. That was back in 97. And then I remember that bit. And then I remember when I was, you know, when you're like coming into teenage years and everything, you're teenage adult and you're starting to become an adult, but you're still a teenager. And I thought, God, he's got all that to go through, how good it is. So I was listening to some music today, or some old music that was right in that age when you're 16 and you think you've sussed life out because you've listened to a few songs and I was like, God, yeah, that feeling that you felt like you'd gone from child to adult and you were sort of playing at it and you felt dead grown up. I thought, he's got that to go through. But then he's got all the things of going to his first day of nursery, first day of primary school, plays, high school. I was thinking, it makes you feel like you, for me, it's made me feel like you have lived an absolute eternity. What's interesting is, as well, there's like a meaning responsibility on, you've got to stay healthy and switched on it, because he's going to need you as much as you can. So you've got to be in it. You've got to be on it until your late 70s, really. You know, you've got to be fit, healthy. So it's definitely sharpened me up that way, you know. Yeah, just that's, I don't know if I've explained that really well, but that's just.
Well, that sounds like that's maybe a nice place for us to sum it up. So in terms of the main outcomes, like I said, a happy life, the main outcome is personal satisfaction. Meaningful life, the main outcome is societal contribution. But the main outcome that Oishi and colleagues posit for a psychologically rich life is wisdom. So that's ultimately what you get. At the end point of living a psychologically rich life, or elements of your life being that, you will end up with wisdom. That's the main outcome that you're going to get. Mm. So for me, a lot of what you were just talking about there is wisdom, isn't it? It's been able to look back on novel experiences, different phases in your life. We talked about the complexity of the narrative, yeah, of or your life narrative. Ultimately, that's what wisdom is, isn't it? It's looking back and going through my life experience, through the knowledge that I've acquired and developed and changed and tinkered with. Yeah. Ultimately, you get to this place of wisdom.
Yeah.
Which to me, that sounds like what you were talking about there. Maybe Leo, so having a child just adds to that. It makes you a little bit wiser, because
absolutely, because like you don't, you know, you've got skin in the game as well before you go out giving loads of advice about things. You think, oh well, if that were me in that situation, I might do that as well. Given that, you actually, you're broadening your perspectives. But what I tend to say a bit more now at the end of my chats with people, I'll say something and then I'll go, I don't know why it's happened, but I've been saying like, do you understand what I mean? Like, it's just become this, you know, does that make sense? I keep saying, and I thought, well, why does that keep coming out all of a sudden? I never used to say that. And I think it's because I'm not presuming. I'll say something like, well, I might do this and this, but I don't live in your life. And that's something else I've been sort of dropping in, and it's like, it's a bit, I suppose that's maybe the wisdom bit. I suppose I'm understanding the complexity of an individual experience and what people are going through. So as some sort of teacher, sort of psychology type person, or people ask for advice, you sort of go, well, I might do this at this time now, but next week, you know, Now, that might be too relative for people. That might be too vague and fluffy. And they might want you to just take the lead and say, no, Danny, just tell me what to bloody do. But I kind of just said, well, but I don't live in your life, so I don't really know. And then the gentle get comments like, thanks very much. That's really helpful. Great advice. Because you've not taken on that responsibility by being a know-it-all. And I think that's another, that's the last thing. You, when you read more and you think a lot, in a weirdly weird way, you're not an idiot as much. You're not protective about your beliefs and I'm right, because you can break them down yourself. You can almost Socrates yourself. You can do the Socratic method on yourself and go, before you come blurting out with that with so much assurity, what about this? What about this? What about this? What if this happened? What about that? And before, and then you just go, yeah, to be honest. So you say something with a bit of conviction and enthusiasm, but if someone then says something back, you'd be like, yeah, I was sort of thinking that myself. But that don't mean you're a dithering idiot and you can't make a decision. It just means that you, so maybe that's the wisdom bit. I don't know.
I think it is. For me, that the wisdom element is, it's not just about knowledge. So it's not just about who's read the most or who's acquired the most knowledge over the course of a life. The wisdom is, it's living that complex life that they're talking about. Mm. So you're getting, you're experiencing, you're not just reading about it, you're also experiencing different things, yeah. Interesting things, different emotions, like they said at the start, good and bad.
Yeah.
Or, you know, having some of those down points that gives you that, you know, negative emotion, but it's good vicarious experience that you've gone through. And then it's more than just the reading and the knowledge aspects of it.
I have a very close friend who's just as wise as me. You know, if you say that I've got some wisdom, whatever level it is, we get on like an house on fire. He gets mainly all his stuff through experience.
Yeah,
in the world, loads of experiences, and right, but we're on the same level. But I get it through experience as well, obviously, but then I add to it with a lot of reading and things and so on. So I'm more biased into that and research and looking at it, but obviously I'm in the world and living experiences, but it's just the other way around with me mate. But we're very, and I take a lot from that. So he'll simplify things a lot, and then when he can't get, you know, and I go, oh, wow, yeah, that's just that, isn't it? I've read all that just for that simple comment that he just said. It's just making someone happy, Danny. I go, oh yeah. You know, and then when he's struggling a little bit and I'll explain it intellectually a bit, he's like, wow, that's so interesting, that's how I'm going to convey this to my next presentation. So yeah, it's experiential and it's informational reading and taking stuff in. It's both. And that's for me, any current level you are at, you can never use the excuse of I'm thick or I'm not clever enough to stretch myself, right? That's not for me. That's not a get out of jail card. Anybody who's got a brain that works can be a bit psychologically richer any day, even if you just watch EastEnders every day. You know what I mean? There's always something you can do. It would be the way you watched it, not just let it pass over you. You know, you could study it, and there'll be lots of value in it. We might go, as if you can learn anything from EastEnders, but you can if you analyze it in a certain way.